Dave Warhol, who was a programmer at Mattel and went on to produce all of the games for INTV Corporation from 1985 through 1990. And I'm Keith Robinson, and Don interviewed me. I remember he interviewed me, gave me a little test to do a little programming thing there, and after I gave it to him, he looked at it and said, well, if we gave out Kewpie dolls, you'd win one. And I got the job.
And I actually recommended we hire him. I've been drinking.
Stephen Roney, the expert on voice.
I did not interview with Don.
Who did not?
Right.
And by the way, Don, you worked for Gabriel Baum, but you and Gabriel were kind of hired the same day, right? When did you first meet Gabriel?
Well, he was here before.
Why, I'm glad, not really, that you asked me that question, Keith, because the infamous story, which is on websites across America, is that you had to take a physical if you joined Mattel in those days. I'm not sure what we had to prove, but you had to take a physical. And Gabriel and I had not crossed paths at the office our first day, but we did cross paths at the doctor's office. We were holding these little white cups at the time. Can I stop there?
Yes,
and stop there.
Out of nervous habit, you went, congratulations!
Hello. Hello. Hi, I'll have to call you back. It's not a good time. Bye. Apologize.
You'll have to thank Tom for calling you right now.
Yeah, that looked impressive, didn't it?
Anyway, I was just starting to introduce Stephen Roney over here, who expert on voice. He was the old-timer who showed me around, because I think you were hired, what, when did you start? September?
October.
I started in October. I guess you started about 2 weeks before I did.
A week or two, yeah.
Yeah, so. He was the old-timer who showed me all the stuff, how to work. But Steve did B-17 Bomber and Space Spartans, did a lot of the voice coding.
I didn't do all of those, because John started B-17 Bomber, for example.
Yes, we're going to get that too. That was one thing, and I was talking about that with Don yesterday. Whenever we talk about, hey, George, we're still making Batman
sounds. Batman sound always the last consideration.
Well, you're the last one here.
That's to plug in the guitar there, George. That's one thing I was talking about with Don yesterday. Anytime we talk about credits and this person worked on this game, there's beyond what the normal credits listed, there's always everyone at Mattel was giving advice and help, whether asked for or not, on games. So there's always a big extension of what the credits were. But anyway, Steve and I are the ones who bought back the rights to Intellivision a couple years ago to found Intellivision Productions. And next to him is John Sowell.
Hello.
Creator of Astro Smash. And started B-17 Bomber and worked with Bill Fisher and Steve on B-17 Bomber before jumping ship to Activision.
Also, I think it's I'm the oldest, not the oldest person, but I taught all of these people everything they know about Intellivision.
But only if we work really late.
Yeah, I think what you were saying earlier about the teaching microphone, Donnie, I think you didn't know assembly programming when you came in.
I had never programmed a line of assembly code. In fact, I thought that assembly was something that happened in a factory in Detroit before I met John Sowell. So everything I ever did in assembly, I owe to Dr. Sowell.
Because the first game you worked on was in BASIC, right? For Geography Challenge for the
I did Geography Challenge in BASIC. I had programmed in Snowball, Lisp, BASIC, Fortran. But I had never done assembly before, and so that was a bit of a jump, and Dr. Sowell was the one who put up with me through it.
We're experts in dead languages.
That's right.
The Sanskrit of the Sanskrit of coding.
Yeah, it was interesting. At Mattel, everything was in assembly language, and in 83, I guess the idea came about of, let's do some investigation. Can we use a higher-level language? And so they turned to our kind of expert systems guy, which was Stephen Roney, to say, could you investigate and see if there is some language, right? And what was your investigation there, Steve?
Now, I don't remember exactly whether that's how it came about or whether it's... They asked me to put today... Well, I was supposed to...
I'm a liar, okay.
I don't remember if it was their idea or my idea or whose idea it was, but there had been some discussion about whether or not we could do a higher level language. But they asked me to put Utopia on the Aquarius computer, which was a Z80. And I didn't know a Z80. A Z80 was nothing like... Nothing like the 1610 that was inside the Intellivision. So through whatever thing made it happen, I don't really recall. I wrote Utopia in C. We had a C cross compiler that ran on. We used a VAX at that time for a DEC VAX for our development machine, and we had a cross compiler to the Z80, which wasn't all that good of a cross compiler, but it wasn't that efficient. But it generated Z80 code. And so over the course of writing it in C, and Utopia was probably a good game for that because it had lots of data manipulation inside, despite the fact that there was no RAM to have any data in on the television. But it was
Dr. Soule taught me how to do that too, do data manipulation
with no
as
data.
If you had RAM when
as
you don't
you
have RAM.
Yes. And so I was able to get the game up and running a lot quicker, although I eventually had to go in and edit the assembly language because in order to make it fit in the cartridge, since we can only games could only be 8K back then most of the time, so at best, and lots of them were even only less than that. So that's essentially ended up being the way I learned Z80 assembly language, so that when they asked me to do a ColecoVision game, I kind of knew Z80's assembly language by then. So I ended up being a jack of all systems.
And at the very end there, the aforementioned, I actually introduced you when you weren't in the room, George, the fat man Sanger, who started out on the game Thin Ice and now is a washed-up has-been in the game industry.
Oh, no, I've been promoted now to, I was a relic last year, discovered relic, and I'm well on my way to becoming a sage with the publication of my upcoming book, and I expect to be a saint within 5 years. But actually, the only thing that applies on this panel is that I worked with Dave Warhol on an Intellivision game, Thin Ice, and I think that what we did represents something that was happening in a lot of other places at the same time, but it's significant that it was one case of somebody who wasn't a programmer working on a game, which was unusual but starting to happen, like little blips. I did music for that game and had nothing to do with programming on that first game. I got more technical later, but I guess I'm the one guy that Dr. Soule didn't teach guitar to.
But that was the fact. When we when the programmers were hired, the programmers were expected to do the sound, music, graphics, everything. There were not specialties at the beginning. Now, as people were hired, it became obvious that certain programmers were better at sound or were better at graphics, and so they would help each other. And so Russ Lieblich, who was hired as a programmer, quickly became somebody who was doing sound effects for the other programmers. And it wasn't until, I think, 82 that we, for the first time, hired a graphic artist who specifically, that was their job, not to program or know how to program, but to do graphics. And I don't believe we ever did hire somebody who was just specifically a sound or a music person.
Nope.
We just kept grabbing, that was the terrible thing, is we would assign programmers to work on a game, and they'd be sitting there working on their own game, and then come up to them and say, oh, this game needs music, or this game needs music, and then they would have to be torn away from their game, do music for something else, and then they'd be asked, why isn't your game on schedule?
There's on the story of the graphics, Connie Goldman was hired as a programmer, and Connie was extraordinarily talented at doing the graphics, and so she ended up doing more and more, and ultimately nothing but graphics, and I actually still work with her today when in Photoshop she says, I miss my pixels, when we just had 8-pixel by 8-pixel tiles to play with. But eventually Connie's graphic style became so kind of good that the marketing department would come out with, when memory dropped down, you were able to make 8K games or 12K games, and when they threw a little extra memory on it and they assigned the project to Connie, the box would say, now with super graphics, and everybody would think that it was some kind of new technology that was in the cartridge, and all it really was that Connie was working on the project.
And the other thing that got done with that, too, and I'm trying to remember who did it, was that one of us, and SiriusX wasn't me, solved the problem of how to have two sprites layered on top of each other so you could get a greater number of colors and greater apparent complexity, mm-hmm. and have them update on the same tick so that they wouldn't jump apart. I don't know if anybody remembers who did that, but that was mm-hmm. that was a worthwhile accomplishment that changed the look of the games.
That may have been Mike Winans on Lock and Chase, mm-hmm. the looping.
I do want to make a mention about sound effects. Russell Lieblich was mentioned. He's not here. He moved back to Activision about the same time I did. He was a music major and hired as a game designer, but he ended up doing sound effects. And the first sound effect that he did that I know of in a game is the hyperspace sound in Astro Smash. He also did the sound in Snafu and a number of other things of that sort. I don't know that we had any music
Snafu was the first thing that actually had music.
Okay.
That little Snafu theme.
That was one of the things that we could start adding once the cartridges got larger.
Right.
Is some of the games would add that. So.
Right. Well, Snafu was still a 4K game, but what happened with Snafu was Mike Minkoff did that game, and it started because Mike was one of the people who was actually at Mattel before Intellivision was really going.
Yeah, Mike was the very first the first Mattel employee who was programmed a game for Intellivision, which was bowling.
Right.
And he had actually started in the computer department at Mattel. So
yeah, but he
predates all of this.
Right, but he had gone into design and development. He was doing handheld games. Mm-hmm. So Snafu actually started as a handheld game he was designing, so the code was even smaller than an Intellivision game code, which is why there was space left over in the cartridge for let's put some music in here.
You mean, we thought we were all being 8-bit programmers, and there were 4-bit programmers at Mattel as well.
But I think it would be interesting, I don't think we've ever talked about it up here, is how music was written, because it's not like... It's not like there was a little keyboard and you wrote music and suddenly it appeared in the game.
No, there were stone tablets and you had these really sharp instruments.
Dave, we're talking about what tools you had to write music.
There were a couple. There was mostly one tool that we used, which wasn't very efficient. But this predates MIDI, the development of music in these kinds of in this era of games. Pretty much, there was one program we had where you could type in. Like the letter A, comma, the octave it was in, and then a duration of the note. And then you just write an ASCII file like that, and there was a conversion program that would change that ASCII string into just a bunch of macros. Ultimately, we had defined byte statements, each line being a macro of, you know, play something this frequency, play something that frequency, play something that frequency. But that tended to be very inefficient data structure, so generally... there were probably a couple of music drivers that became written, but we're so stingy with the ROM space in these things that we would frequently look at the octave range of an arrangement and say, geez, this is never going beyond 3 octaves or 4 octaves, therefore I only need 4 bits or 5 bits to represent the note, and I can use the upper 3 bits as an indication of the a lookup table into the length or something like that. So we pretty much hand compress the music, analyze the music, or even write it within certain limits, analyze it, and then end up with a defined byte statements of what the notes actually were. So I know that Thunder Castle, for example, is like that because it's got a lot of music in it. And then there would be, generally, there would also be little music subroutines. If you had a commonly used line or phrase, you'd, in your data stream, have a little music subroutine that would just go play that bar, repeated bar, or something like that. All of the envelopes were, all of the amplitude envelopes, whether or not the wave was fading out or anything like that, that was all done by hand, too. You'd kind of make little mini patches or something like that. But eventually, with the advent of MIDI, it was possible to capture these what were relatively large data streams, and I would say it didn't really become popular until the 8-bit Nintendo came up, but there was actually one Intellivision game where we captured a MIDI stream and reduced that into defined byte statements algorithmically, and so I think it's the first MIDI track in a game or something like that.
And that's
Keith or George. George found a blues keyboardist to do some... piano riff for it.
I had already claimed on my little curriculum vitae that we'd done the first capturing of musicians live to MIDI for a game called Putt Putt Goes to the Moon on PC, and I hadn't realized that pocket pool was it called?
No, that's what you're playing right now, there, George.
Oh, no, man, deep, my hands are up.
Deep pockets. Super pro pool and billiards.
Well, I guess since that wasn't actually released until.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The game was done in 1990, but it wasn't actually released until 1998 on Intellivision Lives.
I took the first away from there.
but you can hear the original file on the new Intellivision and Hi-Fi Music CD.
And if you run into a guy named Jimmy Martin who plays piano, let him know that he's on that CD, because I can't find him anywhere.
We don't know where he is. And he's not getting any money from it, though. So.
The thing about capturing MIDI, even as far as when we did Wing Commander... there was still no sense of what MIDI was in the general gaming community, and I had to explain to them what MIDI was. In fact, John Miles, who wrote the drivers that do most of the PC games, took me out to lunch, and I had to explain to him what MIDI stood for and why there are black and white keys on the keyboard. But even for as late as Wing Commander, they had a guy pretty much in the basement of Origin looking at the a printout of a MIDI file and programming it then note by note into the language that they would use.
But one thing that now is my chance to ask Dave this question, because I don't think I've ever had a really good answer to this. We're talking about actually capturing a live performance on an Intellivision. The first time it was done was in 1983 on in the game Melody Blaster, which is the one game cartridge that uses the music synthesizer keyboard with the entertainment computer system. All the music in that was performed live over in the D&D department on that keyboard, and using the same program that's actually using the Melody Blaster program, captured it for playback, and it was never used again. I mean, why was that never ever used for later games?
Never heard about it. Probably grossly inefficient. Other than that,
that kind of shows you.
You didn't invent it.
I don't mean to look at it, Keith. I'll, you know, maybe we can get it working again or something.
Well, I think that also shows something. He says didn't know about it is that was done in the design and development department, and there wasn't always a lot of communication between the design and development department and the application software department. So here was a game that was actually done for Intellivision outside of our department. I think it was the only game release that was done outside of our department, and. Well, except for, the original APH games. Here was a game that was done, down the hall or downstairs, and how it worked or exactly what its features were and everything were really kind of unknown to us upstairs.
I think also, George, you were joking about being an artifact or whatever, but I'll say that in 21 years professionally in this business, I've worked for four companies. At all four companies, either I or my team have hired George to do music. So he may joke about being an artifact or whatever, but he has been a factor in this business for a very long time on an awful lot of titles that were important titles. So,
thanks. Is there anything you want us to talk about? You want us to leave?
Chris.
I do not know the name of the person who created the box art. The last time I saw the original box art, I did the packaging for INTV Corporation, and some of the games they reprinted if a game was really popular, they would go back and reprint, but they would take the Mattel Electronics name off. And so one day they sent me over to a warehouse, and all of the original art was there. On a pallet, just that you would move around with a forklift, and just a huge thing. And I think I snuck a few of them out so that we could make. Dave and I made some photo reproductions of them that you could frame. I think we took the motocross one and everything. But then I returned them all. I don't know now where they are. When we bought the rights from Terry, it included in the contract that anything that he still had. Physically, we would get, but he never delivered or said he didn't have anything. Most likely what happened is in the bankruptcy of INTV Corporation, that stuff was locked in warehouses that weren't paid for, and probably the stuff was auctioned off as part of a warehouse. Whether somebody actually has it or whether it's been thrown out, I don't know.
I think it's sitting next to the Ark of the Covenant in this big warehouse.
I'm hoping that someday that stuff will show up someplace, but I do feel terrible about that, just having that one day gone through and been looking through that. Because it was great stuff, because whoever did it, it was like, this beautiful piece of artwork on artboard, and then just in the margins, all of, the paint strokes and stuff, and cleaning off the brush and all of this.
Well, Keith, what about the originals for the INTV series stuff? Do you have those?
Oh, I have those.
Right, okay.
If the original for the later INTV, the stuff that I did. I did the artwork for Thin Ice and Learning Fun 1 and 2 and Diner. Spiker, Super Pro Volleyball, Stadium Mud Buggy. I've got those, but the person who was the Mattel person who did 95% of those Mattel boxes, I've never tracked down. He's worked. Mattel Electronics did not have its own visual design department. We shared that with Mattel Toys. So we had our own marketing department. We had our own. We had a lot of our own departments, but legal and visual design and a couple of other departments, we actually utilized Mattel Toys services. So we never.
They did the instructions for a long time.
They did the instructions, yeah. Mattel Toys did all that. That was part of the visual design, was also that. George?
But y'all didn't actually have what you'd call an art department at Intellivision, right?
Right, yeah. Okay. Mattel did, and we used their resources.
But I mean, even for the games, which is like inconceivable for today's games.
No, you missed that part, George.
Oh, I did. Okay. Yeah,
not till late 82.
I had to go get my meds, man. You don't want me without my meds.
Now, as of late 82, we started hiring dedicated artists, I think.
Yeah, Peggy DeCarli was the first one. Carl Morris, Karen Nugent, Monique Lujan Baker Inc., Joe Ferreira, who goes by the name of Joe King now. I think those were the Daisy work for you, Daisy Nguyen?
Yes.
I think that was our artist, and maybe a couple in the M Network department that I don't remember.
They weren't real artists, Keith, because I remember when Loom came out, there were ads in there. The ads said art by real artists, and your ads never said that.
We never said that, but
we just had super graphics.
Monique Lujan Baker is a graduate of CalArts and a wonderful animator.
Your ads didn't say it, man.
No. Our ads didn't say it, so it didn't exist.
So programming by
concentrated on the gameplay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, Keith, you know, you talked about the separated departments between toy company and electronics. We should tell the Red Dot story. There were armed guards in the lobby who checked your briefcases you left every night because of the history of espionage in the toy business. And so each badge, they had your photo and was color-coded. And so each color had its own thing. And the highest color was yellow, except at some point in the past, they had wanted to create an even higher code. So there was yellow with a red plastic button, not a red dot or a sticker, but a red plastic button that you could feel and was unique somehow.
It was riveted in.
Riveted in. And so, because when we those of us who were there early were actually part of the same toy company design and development group, we had those red dots in our badges. And then for a while after the group separated, people still got the red dot. At some later date, somebody in the toy company said, only people in the toy company should have red dots. At that point, depending on who you ran into, if you were an electronics person from the Intellivision team and you went into the toy company building, you were in danger of being forced to surrender your red dot if the wrong person found you. And a few people were walking around with yellowed badges with holes in them where somebody had accosted them and taken back their red dot. This was the level of corporate sophistication, and this is why Mattel kept its eye completely on the business, because they weren't preoccupied with anything small or petty at the time.
Well, the guards, you know, the guards would check your briefcases, and you could have, you know, key cards and design documents, and that's not a problem. But you better not have a Barbie doll in there.
Yeah. Well, the thing was, when Mattel Electronics started, or just one thing to finish up on that thought, when Mattel Electronics started, they didn't really have a place to put the programmers. They kind of jammed them in wherever they could, and there actually became like three different areas where they found enough space to put them. And I believe some of the programmers, I think, John, you were one of them, worked on the floor. Didn't you work on the floor where they were actually doing Barbie design? And didn't they actually have like armed guards on that floor?
I don't think that was me. I mean, our group, and it's sort of hard to remember because all warehouses look the same once they've had cubicles put in them.
This is when we were still in the tower building. See, because we were, Steve and I were, Mike Minkoff's group was in this one area. We were right outside of toy testing. So as you walked from your office down to the cafeteria, you had to go down to this hallway where you were in danger of being hit in the ankles by a radio-controlled car by these very bored-looking women who were sitting on stools just running these cars up and down the corridor all day. And I think they were deliberately trying to hit us as we were going to lunch. And I forget, Don, where your group was stuck.
We were next to the place where they had the trash dumpster where they would take the machines that had been tested and they would smash them. Because if they just threw them in the trash, people would go and harvest things out of there. And as it is, we did anyway, because some things couldn't be smashed. So we'd be feet up in the air and digging down the dumpster. But you'd walk down the hallway, and here'd be somebody with a speak and spell, perfectly nice-looking speak and spell, and he'd be going, until it was in 17 pieces, throw it out.
And then Bill Goodrich, one of our programmers, would go through that and find Barbie heads and make these disgusting little recreations of Frankenstein Barbies. But there was a third group that was on like the third or fourth floor of the tower.
It wasn't me. I was okay. Never on. Yeah, I was always on the ground floor, wherever I was.
Okay. I was never allowed in the tower.
Well, it was okay. Yes.
A question since you brought up the doll. Did Mattel's very clever marketing people ever try to pressure you to do something with its other high sellers?
Well, they didn't want us to. They were very protective of it. The one tie-in we did was with Masters of the Universe. And the people in Mattel that were dealing with the licensing, the Mattel Electronics legal department and marketing department, not legal, we didn't have our own legal, but the marketing department said that the worst group, the worst company they ever dealt with in licensing was Mattel Toys.
That struck me yesterday. I went to the Activision talk, and they said something that was like totally the opposite of that. That there was something that they did that was licensed, that was easy because it was inside the same company. It wasn't Activision. It was somebody who was experienced outside of when they were outside of Activision. I think when he did something, when he was Atari doing something with Warner Brothers. Because our experience was the opposite. That that doing anything with a Mattel license was much more difficult than doing something with an outside license.
They would send people over to look at, Joe Ferrer was doing the graphics on one of the Masters projects, and they just came over and they said, "You've made the mouth red. It's not red, it's a crimson color." We don't have a crimson color. Well, you can't make it that color. Well, what color do you want to make it? Not that, you know. And it's like, this was the type of, it was just insane. We just couldn't deal with it. But no, I don't think they would have ever let us do anything with Barbie. I think it was proposed. People talked about it. But at that time, that's, ooh, they're not going to let us touch her. Ooh, they don't want our Hot Wheels, yeah. They would have been great. Would have made perfect sense to license those and to develop them. But no, He-Man was the only one that we ever did.
That pink color is copyrighted. If you look at Barbie, I swear to God, no, it's true. The color, the Barbie pink, is a copyrighted color. Read it and weep.
And to give you an idea how that kind of licensing has gone on and gotten more complex, we're finishing up, I'm actually Goff for Good Behavior today, we're finishing up Lord of the Rings on the PlayStation 2 for EA, which is tied in with the New Line movies. EA has a full-time employee in the Bay Area and another full-time employee in New Zealand who do nothing but coordinate approvals for New Line Cinema with the games. That's two full-time heads, which in our day would have been two games. Two full-time heads on nothing but license or approval. Yeah,
a lot of the licenses we had back then, I mean, we did Tron, we did Hanna-Barbera stuff. I don't think Hanna-Barbera cared what we did. You know, it's like, yeah, we bought, you know, Scooby-Doo, and for months, no one ever developed a Scooby-Doo game, and then when the time limit came where we had to release something or we had to pay a penalty to Hanna-Barbera, they just looked at another game that was in development and said, put Scooby-Doo in that one. Same thing happened with Yogi Bear. Mark Buczek had been working on a game for months. Then at the end they said, well, put Yogi Bear in that. And then it tested badly. And they said, well, put some Yogi Bear cartoons in it. And that tested badly. And they said, well, put some different music in there. And that tested badly. And finally they realized what was testing badly was Yogi Bear. People didn't want a Yogi Bear game. And they said, well, okay, let's go back to the original concept. By that time they'd laid off the programmer. And the yellow sheets that we had each week that said the progress of games, it said programmer not available. So the game never came out.
I think one reason they were so patient is I think Joe Barbera, who just passed away recently, but credit to him, I think he got it. I had one, I don't know, half-hour meeting with him one time where he was utterly fascinated by what we did, believed that video games were going to be a long-term thing that were going to last. And I think that's one reason we probably got more rope than we deserved, is that Barbera actually got it. And
we certainly hung ourselves with that rope.
I heard Keith at the time that Mattel was considering, it was choosing between two or three movies at the time that it went with Tron, one of them being the Indiana Jones movie. And
I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
Maybe Don does.
Actually, I don't know what other movies were being considered at the time. I do know a group of us went up to, were invited up to Disney. We were brought in to see this very high-tech presentation, which consisted of some kind of a system of, I don't know, it must have been eight different slide projectors operating under some kind of sophisticated control to show all this different imagery. And we were shown all of the most memorable moments of the film that had already been done by the CG house. So the motorcycle races, the solar sailor, kind of all the ones you know from movie promos, the ones that are remembered now. And so they do this big presentation, marketing is wowed, everybody says yes, the executives go and sign. When the movie came out, all of the best moments were those moments that have been shown us in the 9 months between that show and the movie being released. No more work was done. They actually told us that if you look at Tron, it's actually, much of it's in black and white, and then there's some little flashy colors on it. They actually ran out of time to do it. They had told us they were going to colorize the whole thing, that the uniforms would be vibrant with color. They ran up against their, I think it was a July release date. It was being done in, I think, Taiwan, a lot of the After Effects, and they just ran out of time. So the movie that you see and the movie that was intended are two different things. Mattel committed to the project based upon that promo, that demo that was done, but the movie that came out and what Mattel was promised were two different things.
Yeah, I have a memo that that when they were first planning the release of Tron Deadly Discs, the original manufacturing one, I think, was going to be 300,000. And I have a letter, a memo from marketing where they say, now the movie Tron is going to be huge. 300,000 isn't going to be enough. We need to manufacture 800,000 of these things. And so they did. And the movie came out, and Tron Deadly Disc sold 300,000. So So that's why you can still find shrink-wrapped copies of John Hadley Does Something.
Which, by the way, is one, I think that's my favorite game. I think it's one of the best tuned and one of the most unique algorithms. And if you play it, you can play it with a disc in one hand and then the hand the buttons in the other hand, so you get more control. Technically, on those hand controllers, the disc and the number pad share the same lines in, so you can't use them both at the same time. But in that game, it was designed that if you used like the left wheel and the right button pad, or you could get both controls in at the same time, like having a lot more control over any other game that we had done at that time. And I just thought it was tuned extraordinarily well. That was Steve Sense who did that.
Yeah, and that's also why you did the game Deadly Dogs. You want to explain what that is?
There's a cheap version of, forgive me if I'm forgetting something, but just liking Tron, and but I don't think we could re-release Tron as an INTV game. Dig Dug had been done by somebody for Atari, but not released. INTV Corporation bought the rights to release Dig Dug, and it was a 12K game, and we didn't have any 12K chips at the time. It was either 8K or 16K, and so there was just this 4K sitting right there with, you know, not being used. So I grabbed the Burger Time code, got the hot dogs out, and put them into Tron. The animated graphics from the Tron. So if you hold down probably 47 on both hand controllers of Dig Dug and hit reset, then you'll get Deadly Dogs, which is pretty much Deadly Discs with the hot dogs in there.
And why 47, Dave?
there's a running theme. Don and I both come from Pomona College in Claremont, California, and 47 is just their school number. Keith did a story about this a little bit a while ago, but anytime we have a chance to pick a number, well, that's the number. So the first box art that Keith ever did for INTV Corporation, he never told me this, but it's a football game, and he'd hired the artist, and I went over to look at the thing, and sure enough, it's number 47 who's on that. And there's always a 47 snuck in somewhere on the box art in the INTV productions.
But Will Weaver Baseball, the batter's number is 47, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I want to ask, and afterwards, a guy from Pomona College was hired as a producer on Star Trek, The Next Generation, and so after that period of time, almost every Star Trek episode has a 47 prominently featured somewhere in the episode.
George, what was that?
Yeah, I want to ask a question that'll hopefully start a riot. It's because I'm hearing you guys dealing with all these issues of licensing. And I'm tempted to blame the downfall of games, which of course I don't believe in because I'm doing games now. But I tend to blame which ruined games worse, venture capital or licensing?
Well, I think what happened, I'll throw in this real quickly because I was talking about it yesterday, is that as more companies got into the industry, in order to get in and to get shelf space, you had to have a big license. So a company like Parker Brothers got in by buying Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back for Intellivision, James Bond license, a lot of that. But they were companies that had no experience actually programming video games. So they grabbed the shelf space with big names, but then with horrible games. And so people kept getting burned with these terrible games.
Both? Well,
but
actually,
see, now you have a different mechanism today where the companies that are the console companies can approve. They approve the games in order to get the license. So I think you have a little bit better situation today.
Originally, the first 12 Mattel games, which were mostly sports games, were produced by an outside contractor called APH, and they were commissioned by, I suppose, the marketing department, which was a big believer in getting licenses. So Major League Baseball was licensed, NFL football, NHL hockey. They had to pay the NFL like 5% of each gross or the net or the gross or something, but the NFL and whoever licensed the titles had nothing at all to do with the game, as far as I know. Nobody ever cared whether the NFL football was a good football or not. But that's why. For the earlier sports games, and they thought that was a big seller, if you had PBA bowling, would be a better seller than just a game called bowling. So Atari had a bowling game, which was really, really bad, and television had a very good bowling game, but they thought PBA bowling would just make it sell a lot more. Later, I guess after, as we got more into it, they've started to release like Space Spartans and Astro Smash were not
not based on licensing any existing thing. Of course. Nowadays I have no idea. But I mean, what I should say is, from the very start, there was a lot of marketing input and people saying, "Oh well." I remember marketing was always coming in saying, "We need a motocross game, and we need a boxing game, because we can sell those." And all the programmers, I think every programmer tried to do a motocross game. I don't know if it was ever finished.
Rick Koenig.
Rick Koenig. Yeah, Rick Levine started it, and it was like 4 years later that Rick Koenig actually managed to complete it.
And marketing was right. If you look at what's selling in the arcades today, is a lot of fighting games and a lot of driving games, flying games. But the Intellivision system wasn't really very good for that. So, it wasn't in the old days. It wasn't all that the programmer just sat down and started with a blank slate and made what he wanted to make. You know, it was always, there were always heavy commercial considerations.
It did seem like there was a moment to me, and I'm cartoonizing this. Well, I want you guys to do a sanity check before this goes in my book. Which is, it seemed like there was a moment when it went from let's make a great game, George, to let's make a demo that'll really blow those investors away, and that had the effect of doing something like what Tron did, where they'll make enough game to make a, like if they were making enough movie to make a great trailer, and then once they got approval, I mean, they're two different parts.
Kind of what happened with us, and I think was a and this kind of goes with what John was saying, is that initially, yes, marketing did have a list of things they wanted. They wanted arcade games. They said, let's do an arcade game for us that's kind of like Centipede, so we can say this is our answer to Centipede, or this one is our answer to Pac-Man. But I think we had the brainstorming sessions, Don, that we said, they said, these are the things we want. And like voice, we're going to do an Intellivoice cartridge. But then it was kind of like, we get the programmers together and say, what could you do with voice? Or with the ECS, what could you do with 2K extra of RAM? But what happened was, when they started doing what the marketing department liked to call all flavors, which was, okay, we're now going to start doing this game Burger Time, but we also want it to be on the Atari 2600, and we're going to have our Aquarius system, and we're going to have, we're going to put it on the PC, and we're going to put it on the Apple II. For selling it, for marketing it, it's got to be the same on all systems. So you go to design a new game, and you say, okay, this is what we can do on the Intellivision, and this is what we can do on the Aquarius, but the marketing department is saying it's got to look at the same and it's got to essentially play the same. That brings down every system down to the lowest common denominator, which is the Aquarius. And that was the worst. Is we do a game and we say, well, we have this great feature that we could do this in the Intellivision. Well, we can't do that in the 2600 in marketing, so we'll leave it out of the Intellivision.
And I think that's really, I think, George, referring to what you're saying, I think one of the big changes in the last 20 years is just scale. When we were doing one programmer per project, and then it started to creep up to 1.5 people or even two people, the budget considerations, how much money it cost, wasn't that great. When I founded Stormfront as an independent production company in 1988, our first deal for what turned out to be Tony La Russa Baseball was still only a $75,000 project. Now, at this point, I think probably an effective minimum cost for any title we do is $5 million as a budget. And so what's happening is that the level of financial commitment, as it crept up, you got more lawyers, more bean counters, the attendant marketing budgets get bigger, and so the need to pre-approve, have more people sold in, more suits, it's grown in successive stages over the years.
At that time, the cost of the ROM was more than the cost of the software development budget. I don't know if it was like $2.40 for a 4K ROM or an 8K ROM or something like that.
And but it started
you
out
the
at
math
7 bucks.
On 300,000 units. Boom! It's $1 million. $2 million in
your own games.
Writing your own. Right?
I believe that it's possible to do a homegrown game today that could actually be as good as any of the other games being made for the $5 million. But the companies with all the big bucks are so responsible to investors, who are then responsible to people who have invested their money, that there are certain things they are reluctant to try. So I'd like to put out the challenge to you and your community, if I may be so bold, is to make something that'll really be a great game, whether a million people play it or not. But you've actually got something, an opportunity, that some of the guys up here and some of the guys who are still working don't have.
Yeah, and actually, I would actually support that, because I've been doing this 31 years now. I started on mainframes where we only had text to write games with. there are games, there's gameplay and there's production values. What most of that money is buying is scale, production value, certain manners of execution of a game. The core gameplay underneath is still has the potential to be very basic. There was a moment, Tetris, for an example, is something that's not a sophisticated graphic game, went all over the industry. I was running Broderbund's Entertainment and Education Division at the time, and I am one of a whole number of executives who passed on it because we looked at it and said, wonderful game, but plays great, but today's high-tech advanced values, that won't sell because it's not pretty enough. And boy, do we get our heads handed to us. Now, I signed a distribution deal for SimCity within 2 months of that, so I kind of had a balancing thing. But everybody who was an executive in the late 80s had a shot at Tetris, and only one company took a chance on it. And it just illustrated George's point. The great gameplay should win out despite budgets, despite production values.
Game Developer Magazine, we just talked them into last year into putting in a page about audio every month. During the conversations that I had in email, it came bouncing back to me that there was no regular game design feature in Game Developer Magazine. And someone was arguing over space being given to music. And I said, dude, forget the music, man. It may be what I've dedicated my life to, but if game design isn't getting a page, man, put us back on the bottom of the heap of game
one
design.
One of the things that disappoints me when you're talking about asking people are they designing their own games out here is that some of the stuff that I've seen that people have done, you know, new, supposedly, for games recently has simply been to take a game that wasn't available on a certain platform and put it on that platform. And I think one thing we're talking about here is do something original. Somebody was come by the booth the other day that had a ColecoVision version of a game that was just an arcade game that had never been on ColecoVision. Really, we're talking about something just totally new, original, and fun.
Well, let's say, just on the game design aspect, I'm sorry, a project would be about 3 to 6 months, one person, that's about the time frame. If you think about it, there really were no assets to connect. There weren't tons of 3D models. There weren't tons of backgrounds. There wasn't tons of palette tricks. The only thing you had to do, or the only, you know, you'd get all your graphics hooked up, and then a day and a half later, you'd program the game. So we spent, in my case, we spent most of our time actually playing the game. You come in, you play it, you tune it, you tune the rules, you play it with other people. What do you think? What do you think? It was actually gameplay programming because they're just, you know, there weren't that many other things you could do.
That and making it fit.
Yeah. You had a question, right?
Yeah, I would say that what you're saying would make sense because if you think about the games as a player, years later, 5 years after the game is done, or 10 years after it's had its lifespan, you know, on the market, everybody thinks about the games that were great as a playable game, not as how great the graphics or the packaging were, because clearly that evolves and always the graphics are always going to improve. But you think about the game play years later. That was a great game.
Or the license, or the license itself. I mean, we did three. We did Tron Deadly Disc, Tron Mazatron, and my game, Tron Solar Sailor. Tron Deadly Disc is the only game that anybody really plays anymore. It's the only one that's really fun. I'm including my game.
And let's tip our hats to the guys who are really doing it now today, too. I mean, the big budget people. There's, I play Warcraft 3 a couple of times a day sometimes, and they've got all that cinematic stuff where they show how well they can render feathers and wheat blowing in the wind, and great, you know, that's fine, but it's also a great game, so it can be done. How long did it take them to make that?
About, figure, 18 months.
Yeah, I know you guys overplay.
We have 53 people on the team at this point. So, you know, one other thing I want to give credit for, too, because first of all, I think Dave's point is very important about the amount of time that was spent tuning and the fact that you could focus on that. Out of those 53, we have 7 people whose job title is game designer and are focused on that, but the thing has so many moving parts and so many interconnections that it is very different. I think the other thing is to tip my cap to the top programmers we had, I remember one night in particular, although this happened all the time, Steve Roney and Mike Minkoff, who is not here, Steve, you and Mike, about 7 o'clock, and this memory is frozen in my mind forever, and you were sitting looking at a screen, and you were helping somebody, I don't remember who it was, but a newer programmer, and you were looking at a problem, and of course, always making these things fit. Initially, when I did Utopia, that was 4K, and then after that, we got 8, but still very, very small. And so you spend a lot of your time not only tuning, but trying to squish and compress and figure out how to get more out of less.
Because when an 8K game was finished, as far as the way you wanted to play, it was always 9K.
Yeah. Utopia went to 5K about 15 different times, and that included when it was about a third done. But Steve and Mike were sitting there helping this person, and Steve, you looked at the screen and you said, I can write that routine in 12 decals, which is the equivalent of a byte. I can write that routine in 12 decals. And Mike would frown and stare at it, and he had a very, Mike has a very dark, intense look. He just, you can see all the intensity inside him. He would stare at it for a few minutes and go, I can write that routine in 10 decals. And Steve would kind of sit back. I can see you doing this, and just look at it and come back. Eight decals. I can write that in 8. And the person watching was going to school on this because these guys were tremendously masterful programmers. I could never come close to what those guys did. And it was a learning experience. And this happened over and over again. It is one of my fondest memories. And I know the way you, and Dr. Sewell, the way you taught me, I just have such huge respect for the combination of creativity and technical knowledge you guys brought to the party on that.
On Tron Solar Slater that I was working on, I had the same thing. I had 12K to work with, and I just kept designing and putting in stuff. Yeah, about 5K of that was voice data. And so I just kept designing stuff and doing this, and my game was like 16K. And I kept telling Mike, I'll optimize it later. But I had this deadline because they were sending me to France to interview programmers for the French office. And so like October 15th was this drop-dead deadline, and I was fast approaching it, and my game was still 4K over. So Mike assigned Gene Smith, another programmer, to work on the game with me to optimize it. So I would give him my code, and I'd be working on it, and then he'd come back the next day and say, I found a way to cut 100 decals out of that routine you wrote. And I'd go, great, that's another feature I can put in. And he goes, no, that's not it. And I just drove Gene crazy for about a month or so. And I just want to say that because Gene died about a month ago. And I just had a lot of fun working with him on that. I tortured him on it, but...
There's a great attitude about programming that you guys might or might not run into very much. I mean, I always think of Bill Volk, who was he did Manhole and a bunch of other games, but we were working on some non-game things with him, designing some graphics programs, and Bill would walk into the room and he'd be excited, I mean, pumped up. He's a huge guy, and he'd go, oh man, I'm doing splines now, and you don't want to know how I do splines. Don't ask me how I did splines on that one chip. I don't know what chip, you know, he said, on the 6565. I did splines on the 6565. Don't ask me how I did it. Don't ask me how I did it. Don't even ask me how I did it. Here's how I did it. and that's what, you know, you see new platforms coming out, like the telephones and things, that are small and are going to require this kind of passion and this kind of thinking. At the web, you know, and I don't run into people who bust a corpuscle getting excited about how they can do things like that. I think maybe I suspect the demo scene was like that, but I don't know where those people are right now. But if you run into them, I think those will be the people who do some very cool
stuff.
They're
buried inside the teams, though, and they're so deep that the press never sees them, the fans never get to see them anymore. That same personality, it'll be about frame. I got to run at 60 frames a second. Don't ask me how. I've had that conversation in the last 2 months. But the guys are so buried, the press don't see them.
We're running out of time here, so let's get...
I'm going to follow up the gameplay ability. You mentioned testing, like the Yogi, you brought testing. You tested it, but what does that mean exactly? Testing?
That's focus group stuff, but the marketing department would go out into malls and essentially just accost people and say, would you like to look at these new video games that are under development, and just grab them and pull them into a room in a mall and show them stuff and say, okay, well, you know, do you like this, do you like that? In some cases, and see, this is very bad, in some cases what they're showing them is a piece of paper with a marking pen drawing of what the game might look like within like 5 bullet points of what this game does and say, would you buy that game? And then they come back and tell us, say, no, they don't want, they won't buy that. And we say, well, from this, I wouldn't buy it either. But you know, games lived or died based on that. Anything else? Yes. Right. We own the copyrights of the software. We own the copyrights on the software of it, so it's a lot of that was joint copyright stuff. So like with Tron, Disney controls, you know, the characters, kind of the plot, some of the, you know, they have the name, so we can't release Tron Deadly Discs unless Disney says okay. you know, Burger Time, the game, the Data East arcade games, Burger Time, Lock and Chase, Bump and Jump, Mission X, that's owned by Data East Corporation. In the case of Data East, they feel that their games are still viable. They just, a couple years ago, they did Burger Time on the Game Boy as Burger Time in Bedrock with the Flintstones characters. So they feel there's still life in that, and they don't really want the old blocky Intellivision version out there to their thinking, sullying the image of the arcade version. So, what was that? I think it would help them, and that's the argument we make. We make that it's, you know, putting it in context, putting the historical thing in there, and we always tell them, we'll advertise your new version. If you've got a version, actually Midway released Burger Time, a very nice version for PlayStation and PC a couple of years ago, that's the actual arcade version, plays just like the arcade version. We say, yeah, we'll advertise that. But people keep coming and ask for the Intellivision version, let the collectors play that. Now, in the case of Disney, when we went to Disney and said we want to put the Tron games onto Intellivision Lives, their response then was, they hadn't done anything with Tron for years, and their response actually, quite honestly, was that, well, we don't know what the legal ramifications are. You know, their legal department told us, we don't know. Kushner Locke was a production company that originally developed the movie Tron. We don't know if the rights have reverted to them or if we still have full rights. We don't know if Jeff Bridges has to be contacted for approval of any licensing deal. We don't know if 5 years ago we didn't give these rights to another company and that deal is still going. In order to find out, we'd have to go out to a warehouse someplace, pull the box off the shelf, because none of this stuff was computerized then, go through, and it's going to cost us $5,000 to $10,000 in research and legal fees to do that. And for your little, you know, nickel and dime CD, where, you know, we were offering them like $6,000 to do it, it's not worth our time. It's not worth our, you know, it's frankly not worth our time to do it. Now, things change now that Tron is back on track to possibly have a sequel, and definitely they're doing a new Tron computer game, Tron 2.0, that'll be out, I think, later this year. Now, that's kind of changed, and we're talking to Disney again. Because now they know where the rights are, they know who the things are, and it's no longer a case of they have to do a lot of research. So we're actually talking to Disney again about being able to release the Tron games, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do that by the end of this year. one of the options is that instead of us releasing it, they will include some of these games on something that they're doing. It's all just a possibility at this point, but we're talking about it, so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about all this stuff. Actually, with the we don't have the money or the power behind us to convince Data East about those arcade games like Burger Time. However, THQ Wireless, who is now putting the Intellivision games onto cell phones, they're talking to Data East and saying, you know, hey, that Intellivision version of Burger Time, could we maybe put that on the cell phone? And if that deal goes through, we're hoping to include with that, to piggyback with that, the ability to re-release it again ourselves. So there's always, so this stuff is always being played back and forth. That's like, you know, never give up on us. We're always trying.
Yeah. we're doing our best to get all of the ROMs legally available. And
125 games, we want them all out there. Some of them, you know, I just don't see legally how we'd ever untangle finding who has the rights to the Parker Brothers software on Empire Strikes Back and then convincing Lucas to allow us to do it. Because all of those cases, you have a double deal. You have to find, first of all, who has the rights. I mean, the ColecoVision rights are all screwed up now. And then find then who had the arcade rights on top of the ColecoVision rights. So that's a real mess. But we are aiming for all the games that were original games. Actually, between Intellivision Rocks and Intellivision Lives, you have everything except, I think, for two games that were titles that were originally done for the Intellivision, not involving a license. The two interphase games, Sewer Sam and Blockade Runner, are the only two, because every Coleco game that they did for Intellivision, every Parker Brothers game, every Sega game, the one Sega game, are all translations from something else, and the Atari games. So with Intellivision Lives and Intellivision Rocks, all of the Amagic games, all of the Activision games, they were all original titles, and they're all on there. So
show special, $50 for both.
I'm sorry, I'm getting too commercial here. But we are working on it. We are working on it. So yeah, there are licensing considerations and stuff, but we're fighting it. Other questions before they kick us out? Yeah.
Who came up with the classic hearing
section? That's an APH sound effect. It's pretty much just white noise that ramps in and out, and there's you could call it with a duration. It's called call cheer or call crowd.
Call crowd.
All right, and you'd give it a parameter. The operating system was always running. There was a audio subsystem of that. It actually did run at 60 frames a second, but it would ramp in the white noise
I think Dave is saying he's responsible.
No. APH. Sound designers at APH. But it has these two little horn hoots and then the little random whistle, but it was based on random numbers. So it would just sit there and it alternates between the whistle and the toot and the whistle and the toot for as many seconds as you told it. But if you listen to it, it's just it's purely random little toot, toot, toot. And I mean, to this day, I still go around saying call crowd or buzz ha, which was the it's just that half-second buzz, yeah.
Another phrase that came about from that is that we had the random number, so there was call RAN to get a random number, but the random number never seemed to be as random as you thought, so we actually referred to it often as call RAND ESP, because it seemed to always give you the number that it wanted to give you as opposed to a real random thing.
Oh, and the another thing is that the baseball, you're out, that was somebody at APH trying to make the sound chip go A-E-I-O-U, and then when he listened to it, it just goes, ow. And there's, oh, that sounds like you're out. But they threw that in the baseball game.
And then once they did the voice unit, they were prohibited from ever trying to make the sound, original sound chip talk anymore.
Right, yeah, because it would take away from it.
Yeah, you couldn't.
So, I think that about wraps it up, unless somebody has a really pressing question, because I see John back here, who's basically
going to give us the hook on it.
And he's bigger than we are.
But if I may just say one thing, George Sanger is here with his band, Team Fat, all the way from Austin, Texas, just to entertain you. He's going to be performing the theme from Thin Ice live with a surf band.
We'll do some surf versions of the Seventh Guest tunes and Zombies Ate My Neighbors. There'll be some good surprises.
But the Thin Ice thing, it's on our new Intellivision and Hi-Fi CD. I think it's going to be about, 12:30? It's going to be between the break between the next talk and the one after.
We'll do one set at 12:30 and a second set totally different at 3.
Okay. Be there. Please.